Welcome, everybody, to the second part of our series, to our motion series on the Langer case. Tonight's class is being sponsored by Avi and Rivi Katz of Teaneck, New Jersey, in loving memory of Avi's father, Dr. Norman Katz. It's the observance of his sixth Yahrzeit on the upcoming on the 9th of Shvat. Dr. Katz was a Renaissance man, the true Torah umat, the person, a Talmid of the Rav of Soloveitchik. He taught professor of mathematics at Washington University for close to 50 years in St. Louis, and unfortunately could not, would have very much enjoyed Dr. Mark's classes, so we want to thank him for the Katz family for their sponsorship, and we want to thank again the Sasson family, who are sponsoring Joseph and Jacob Sasson and sponsoring the whole series in memory of their father, Albert Sasson, Avram Ben Sala. And we should all be blessed with good health and long life. And with that, let's get to see the controversial Heter explained. Vakasha, Dr. Mark.
We still have some preface till we get to the Heter, but maybe we'll get to it. You know us. And again, I thank you for all the sponsors and to Rabbi Kelman. Many people, I'll just mention it because he hasn't, you know, so many people now come and enjoy. If you enjoy the classes, they would very much appreciate leaving a little donation so we can continue to do this just as long as Rabbi Kelman puts in the effort, I'm here. I want to begin with a shout out to the Ann Arbor Orthodox Minyan, Ann Arbor, Michigan. I was there last Shabbos, and it was a wonderful Shabbos, and I think we might have some listeners from there who are joining us now, so thank you all. Last class, which was our first class of the semester, I didn't go back to any comments from before that, so let me just take a few minutes quickly just to do that. Thank you for a number of people who pointed out you know, we spoke about the Rambam and why the laws of mourning are in Sefer Shoftim. So a number of you pointed out that the Rambam himself explains that. Yeah, I overlooked mentioning it. I mean, he mentions it, Halbertal, that the Rambam himself says, if you look like in the introduction there, he says that the laws of Sanhedrin deal with people who have been executed from the court, and executed people are not, there's no avegos for them. So in theory, at least, that's the reason. But Halbertal's whole point is that's a bit of a stretch, and he thinks there's more to it than that. And the other interesting point, which I raised, is, well, what about Hilchos Tzedakah and Mezuzah? What are they doing in Yeridea? So I thank you, Eitan, for pointing out, well, the tour, he mentions that... Where's his language here? You quoted it for me. Yeah, the Torah says that Yoredeya covers the things that you need. Basically, it's a catch-all for all the relevant practical things. Orachayim in the Torah's Hakdama, he says that those things that you do from the time you wake up till you go to sleep. So, tzitzis, tefillin, sefer Torah, but I don't know, tzedakah, sort of could be put in there, and avegos, I think, but maybe not. Maybe we're dealing with just things that happen all the time, and I guess that's what it is. At least that's what Eitan says, and it makes, I mean, that's clearly why, but my point was, you could just as easily, if you put tzedakah and you put avegos in Orach Chaim, no one will bat an eye. And so what? So you say that these are the Seder Hayom, from the time he gets up and goes to sleep. Well, you know, Esrog only comes once a year for a few days a year. And yet that's an Orach Chaim, and Tzedakah is supposed to be every day. And so it still is a bit of a problem, I think. Well, not a problem. It's a little strange, maybe. One of you, I forget now, called, I just want to show a picture in case people didn't catch it. We spoke about Slonimsky, the great inventor, and someone pointed out, which I think I knew Avram Stern, but I didn't know that he invented, as it says here, a mechanical calculator. So thank you very much for pointing it out. And look, take a look at his picture. I mean, that's when Jews looked like Jews. Look at how he looks, and yet he was an inventor, and very nice. Okay, I need to I don't want to say apologize, but I need to clarify and maybe push back on something I said. I was speaking about Japan and how. Oh, thank you very much, Sarah. Okay, I was thinking how in Japan that the Chazon Ish gives his date when Shabbos is on Sunday. And by the way, for the Chazon Ish people, it was only Sunday. Rav Chisel Levenstein comes into shul in Shanghai wearing on Shabbos wearing tefillin. And Rav Chaim Kanievsky today, well, he's no longer unfortunately alive, but he said that you only observe it on Sunday. And then I told you about the other position that it's Shabbos. That Shabbos is Saturday. And no one said to observe both days. Yom Kippur, there are a few who tried to do both. But and I said though, today it's become a popular thing. What I didn't know is that there really is, I thought it was just something from let's say current rabbis, hashgacha organizations. It actually is deeper than this. So this is, I think, a fascinating, and I thank you, Baruch, for calling my attention to at least Rav Yoshev. This is a fascinating example where we can say we've seen, like in the last 20 years, a change in recommended halachic practice. I'm not sure whether this is for people who live there also or just for travelers. So, for instance, there's a whole sefer called Tariach Yisrael by Rabbi Taplin, a big book on the dateline. And he, on page 27, although he cites Rav Yoshev as saying that the accepted position is to observe Shabbos on Saturday, I mentioned that last class, in the note, he says that he mentioned someone who asked Rav Yoshev in 1991, and Rav Yoshev said to him that to be machmir midyaraisa from Torah laws on Sunday, like the Chazon Ish. Now, this is interesting because who knows what's a Torah law? They have to put out a whole booklet to tell you what is a Torah law. Most of us don't realize what's a Torah portion or not. So here you see Rav Yoshev stating that that's his recommendation. So there's good reason, I guess, for the people who say that. I don't think the tourists are doing it, but in the Haredi world, I guess they would. But it's not only the Haredi world. Here's another example, which I found. Rav Osner in Shevet HaLevi, volume 6, number 34. If you know how close Rav Osner was to the Chazon Ish, it's actually amazing what Rav Osner says. Rav Osner says that the Ikar Halacha is Sunday, is Shabbos, not like the Chazon Ish. And he says, now we're dealing with a situation that people always have observed Shabbos on Yom Shvi, and therefore Chalilo Zel Zel B'Shabbos Shalahem. We can't not observe Shabbos on Saturday. But then he says, nevertheless, you have the Chazon Ish, and you can't ignore the Chazon Ish. So he says, also midyaraisa, Torah prohibitions don't violate them. But what's the most fascinating to me? Because if you know Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook was not a fan of the Chazon Ish. Obviously, he understood his learning, but he didn't think of him as a posek. He told everyone to follow Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, a Rabbanut poskim. He thought in fact, I'll let you in on a secret that is never, I don't think I've ever mentioned it here, so we should record it for posterity. I used to write for tradition a lot years ago. And then I had an article, this is taking us back to the 90s, and the editor censored it. Or said it had to be censored. What had to be censored? I quote what Ritzvi Yehuda Cook says about the Chazon Ish. So he's not the leading posek. He says my father is the leading posek, but then other things as well. Now you'll find this in my book, Changing the Immutable. But the editor said I don't want to include this because it's tearing down the Chazon Ish, which I don't understand. What are you tearing down? Who's tearing down anyone? It's a comment by Ritzvi Yehuda Cook, who also was a gadol. Now, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, one of his students, was Rav Yaakov Ariel. And I saw today, this is the most surprising. Rav Yaakov Ariel, the Rav of Ramat Gan, made probably the leading posek in the religious Zionist world today in Israel, I should say, not in America, but in Israel. He was asked this question, and he says that since the minhag is, the practice is to observe Shabbos on Saturday, but since the Chazon Ish makes many good points, he says, min haroi, it's best to abstain from d'oraisa, Torah violations on Shabbos. And that's Rav Ariel. Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook would not accept this at all. I'm just convinced of that. We've got a couple more minutes here.
Abstain on Sunday.
And I'll get to the comments in the end. A couple of you raised the point, first to Ian, about sacrifices. Remember, I quoted Rav Moliver that sacrifices are only after the ego, that before that, maybe you had people on their own could do a sacrifice, but you don't have commanded sacrifices. And that's how you explain the verse in Jeremiah that when you left Egypt, I didn't command you in sacrifices. Well, he quotes the Abarbanel. Yeah, thank you, Ian. The Abarbanel in Yirmiyahu says the same thing. And then he, thank you, Ian, for also mentioning how Shaddai rejects this. But there's a problem here. And Baruch again points it out that, what about Karban Pesach? And, you have some other karbanos also that, I think he mentions it here. Yeah, your carbon Pesach, also carbon Bechor. You have other carbonos also that are before the sin of the ego. So I don't get it. I don't understand Rav Moliver. I don't understand the Abarbanel. And finally, we're speaking about Mamzerus, which is not illegitimacy the way it's often translated. It's certain relationships. When a child comes out of it, the child is considered a Mamzer. And we spoke about mom. Someone asked Charlie. I asked about a convert marrying a mamzer, and I said yes. And then I for some reason, I threw out that it's the male convert to the female, not vice versa. But as soon as the class was over, I realized I made a mistake. And it's explicit in the Rambam that it goes both ways. It says in Yisurei Bia, chapter 15, halacha 7, mamzer mutar lisag yoris. Now, what I was confused with and what led me astray for a minute is earlier in the Rambam, he talks about that a mamzer could marry a shifcha, Canaanite maidservant, or however you want to translate it, and a maidservant, and that could be betaher the children, and it doesn't go the other way. It's not that like a female mamzer could marry an eved. It doesn't work like that. That's what I was confused with. And this solution, by the way, which they could have used in the Langer case, has been adopted and has been used by Poskers, Zalman Achimek, Goldberg, and others. It's not a class in mamzerus. Maybe we'll get into it a little more later, but that's leave that aside. Okay, let us now pick up. Where's my paper smart? Oh, here. So pick up with the Langer case, and I'll give you a quick summary again so everyone have the facts. Here's an article that which Yair Halevi has mentioned. I forget if I showed it to you last class, that the Parshat Ha'achla Achot, that is the Langer case, that's what it's called, symbolize the beginning of the new era in Haredi leadership. And we talked about that. We'll talk more about that. I think the last thing I mentioned was, or I mentioned last class, it wasn't the last thing, but how I showed you this book called Hamaracha al Atzal Rabbanut, that is the effort to save the Rabbanut in Israel from the danger of Rabbi Goren's candidacy. Because Rav Goren, he thought you could go up on a Temple Mount, and he spoke about liberalizing conversion and how there was room for in halacha for flexibility. Rav Goren would distinguish, it's going to be an important part of our story, distinguish between how you decide halacha in the Golos versus how you decide halacha in a modern Jewish state, where you have a responsibility for the whole people. We're going to see that this plays a very important role in the Langer case. And this book is full of, well, it's more of a booklet, is full of criticisms of Rav Goren's approach, including legitimate, valid criticisms reflecting a different perspective. But one of the things, I just want to mention this before we go further and return to the case, because I just think it's so strange, is that in order to undermine Rav Goren, that he's not worthy of being chief rabbi, he says that, well, first of all, he mentions that, another thing he mentions, that Rav Goren would rely on the Yerushalmi. There are times that Rav Goren relies on the Jerusalem Talmud. That's not the standard approach. In conversions in particular, he will rely on it. He thinks that as we return to the land of Israel, we have to give the Jerusalem Talmud more of a role. And so, for instance, in the Bavli, it has comments like, it has a comment about that converts are hard for us. And there's an attitude that you have to be very strict on conversions and push people away. He points out that that's not found in the Jerusalem Talmud. And he, based on that, he develops the idea that we can have a different approach to conversion in the land of Israel. We'll come back to that later when we deal with the Seidman case. But this attack, it's on page 26. What does it attack Rav Gorin for? Rav Gorin gave an interview. I'm sure he wrote about it as well. He says that in dealing with certain ideas of the Rambam, we just can't accept them. And what is the example? Two examples he offers. I'll show you here. So already you might think that this is going to be problematic just from what I said. But look what the what he says. Okay, so the first one I want to show you is Hilchos Yesodei Torah, chapter 2. If you look at Halacha 3, it says here. Is talking about the heavenly spheres and everything. He says that the matter from which they, the spheres and the stars, b'kochav galgalim, b'kochav, kochav doesn't mean stars. It means heavenly things in the heavens. It also means planets, as we'll see. The matter from which they are composed differs from a simple conception of matter, and their form differs from a simple conception of form. His whole point, the Rambam's point, is that the matter of the planets is a different type of matter, and Rambam will explains that they remain permanently, they don't degrade, and Rav Gorin says that that's we've already astronauts have been up there, and they brought back some of the moon, and we can see that the Rambam's wrong about this. Second, he calls attention to this passage. Well, here this is chapter 3. You can see from just the first halacha that. He refers to Kochav, for example, Kochav Tzedek. What's Tzedek? It's Kochav means planet. Tzedek. Tzedek, it tells you it's Jupiter. So what does he say about the heavenly, the planets, the stars and all that in Halacha Tes? All the stars and spheres possess a soul, knowledge, and intellect. They are alive and stand in recognition of the one who spoke and brought the world into being. They are aware of themselves, the angels, So the Rambam has this idea that the heavenly being, that the planets are alive. By the way, when he says spheres, this is old Aristotelian astronomy, or I should say Ptolemaic. You have, let's say, the planets, and they're each in a sphere, and the sphere moves as it moves. The planet moves around the Earth. And even the sun moves around the Earth, but the sphere moves, and the planet moves inside the sphere. Now Rav Gorin says we see clearly that they're not alive, and the Rambam he says stated this based on the astronomical ideas, Ptolemy, that this was popular and accepted in his day, and the author of this goes after him. What chutzpah is he to say the Rambam wasn't right? And the Rambam put this in Yesodei Torah, which is, the essence of the Torah. Is he a Chabad person here writing? That Chabad thinks that everything in Yesodei Torah has to be true. But that's, this isn't a Chabad person writing this. And it's obviously it's not true. In fact, Rav Kafach said it's the most important thing to say it's not true. Because if you say that this is prophetic, and that this has to be true, then this is going to lead people to reject the Torah. Because anyone knows anything about science knows that what Rav Gorin says is correct, that the moon is not a living being. It doesn't praise God, anything like that, other than maybe in a metaphorical sense. But so if you conclude that this is Torah Misinai, and it's obviously wrong, then you can conclude that the Shabbos is also Torah Misinai. So throw out Shabbos, throw out Kashrus, throw out Judaism. So you need to say that those things that the Rambam is citing, he's using the best knowledge of his day, and it's not from prophecy or anything like that. So I just think that it's an example of the foolish attacks on Rav Gorin. There will be attacks on Rav Gorin which are not foolish, which you might even agree with them. Wait till you see what we see today. But this is an example. I think it's like once the floodgates open, then everyone starts, throwing everything, including the kitchen sink, at Rav Gorin, and sometimes the attacks backfire. Okay, just to summarize again, to remind ourselves, what is the case? A girl, Chava, let's call her just Chava, 14 or 15, meets a non-Jew in Poland named Barakowski. They run off and live together. She converts to Christianity, but later She rejects Christianity, we're told, and he, well, she does reject it, and he converts. Why does he convert to Judaism? Apparently, the father of Chava forced him to. It's one of the versions. They move to Israel. Oh, they get married also. So they claim they get married, or it is claimed they get married. They move to Israel. They separate, no divorce. Chava meets another man, has children. This man's name is Langer. So she has two children called Langer. She was halachically married. She never got divorced halachically. So here you have two children are born. There could be a problem. They could be a mamzer. That's the case. And a mamzer can't marry other Jews. Now, okay, so let's pick up with our story now. In that, the based in Israel knew about this because when Chava Langer wants to get married after with she was married to Langer, and that when that marriage ended, he died. She wanted to get remarried, and then it was recorded that then that her other two children that and that she would previously been married before she was with Langer, and therefore they're mamzerim. So it was recorded in 1955. It was recorded in a book. The kids are young. No one thought of it. Fast forward, 1966. The son, Chanoch Langer, comes to the Tel Aviv rabbinate to get a marriage license. He wants to get married. And he's refused because they say he's doesn't have the yichus. He's a mamzer. So begins the odyssey. He hires a lawyer. And by the way, his sister is now in the same situation. So they hire a lawyer. And they appeal this to the Beis Din HaGadol. Israel has a supreme Beis Din. The official name is Beis Din HaGadol Erurim, the High Court of Appeals. This was created by the British government insisted that this be created because when they took over after World War I, they said you can't have a modern country without having an appeals court. Now, the proto-Haredim, the people who you, I guess you'd say were the Haredim before we had that term, some of them attacked this and said this goes against the Gemara that says that one Beis Din can't overrule another Beis Din. It's really not true because this idea of appeals court, we had it in Spain, we had it in the Ottoman Empire. The idea is that when anyone goes to a Beis Din, you accept the fact that a higher Beis Din, if it finds that the lower Beis Din has made a mistake, can reject it and overturn it, just like we have in all our countries. And if you look at who has served on the high Beis Din, I mean, talk about a chutzpah to say there's a problem with the High Court of Appeals. Every one of the greatest gedolim who had any connection at all to the state of Israel, or even before the state, served on the Beis Din HaGadol, and will be introduced to some of these names. So they appealed to the Beis Din HaGadol, the rabbinic high court, to overrule this claim of Mamzerus, to investigate it. And it was obvious that there was room at least to question the decision that the Beis Din should at least look at it. Well, the Beis Din HaGadol, the high court, was not yet ready to examine it. It sent it to the Beis Din of Petach Tikva, which was a very respected Beis Din under the supervision or the Beis Din, his name was Rav Shlomo Shimshon Karelitz. This is the nephew of the Chazon Ish. Rav Shlomo Shimshon Karelitz's father was Rav Meir Karelitz, who was really the rabbinic advisor for what is known as Poalei Agudas Yisrael. And he was the Beis Din. Before him, the Beis Din had been Rav Reuven Katz, the famous, the Degel Reuven. We've spoken about him a number of times because one son of his is Rabbi Michal Katz at YU. Another son was Rabbi Liam Katz in Passaic, New Jersey. And another son was Abraham Katz. He was the head of Dropsy and NYU. What are they all doing in America? There was another son who was a Dayan in Eretz Yisrael. Well, Rabbi Reuven Katz was the Rav of Hoboken for a few years. So, I'm not sure if they stayed in America or what the story is, but so Rav Karelitz took the case, and who else was on the court? One other person is worth noting. His name was Rav Michal Zsolti. Now, there's a figure of Betzalel Zsolti who's going to play a very important role in our story, and his brothers Rav Michal Zsolti. These are all Hebron Talmidim, Hebron students. Now, the name is written with a Z, and it's sometimes with a little apostrophe, but usually not. In fact, in Rav Rejolti Sefer, it doesn't have the, with an apostrophe next to it. And when you have the apostrophe, that usually means like a J. So people often pronounce it Rejolti. I asked Yair Halevi, and he said it's pronounced like the Z in Volozhin, ZH. So it's Jolti. That's how we'll pronounce it. And the court, this based in, looked into the matter and found no reason to change the earlier ruling of the Beis Din, which really didn't investigate it, but just looked at the basic facts that a married woman had children with another man without getting a divorce and declared them mamzerim. And the Beis Din and Petach Tikva accepted this. Now you have an opening to go to the Beis Din HaGadol, because the Beis Din in Petach Tikva didn't do anything. So the Langers appealed to the Beis Din HaGadol. And in January 1970, this Beis Din, listen to the three people on this Beis Din. One is Rav El Yashiv, Rav Yosef Shalom El Yashiv, who today is known as the great halachic authority, the final word in the Haredi world, who for over a decade was the most important person in that world. And yet, before he joined the Haredi world, we'll see, well, it's because of the Langer case, he was in the Rabbanut, and he was a dayan, but recognized as a genius. That's one of my big criticisms of the Haredi world. Had he never left the Rabbanut and never left the Beis Din, he would have lived his life, he would have retired, and he just would have been known as a Talmud Chacham. He only could become the Gadol Ador for the Haredim when he left the Rabbanut. That shows that for the Haredi world, a lot of it has nothing to do with his halachic learning would have been the same, but his hashkafa would have. So as soon as he got in line with the Das Torah of their world, but then they could accept him. But he was never totally in line with their Das Torah, because when he believed in the Rabbanut, unlike Rav Shach and the Sleipner, as soon as he becomes the Das Torah, he starts telling all his followers to become Dayanim and let's take over the chief rabbinate. I think many religious Zionists preferred the old way, when the B'nai Brak crowd would simply ignore the Rabbanut. Now they've taken it over, and the chief rabbis routinely are from the Haredi world. So that's one of the Dayanim, and he is a super genius, Rav El Yashiv, appointed by Rav Herzog. And you can read I have to say that the biography written by his grandson does not cover any of this stuff up, how he was in the Rabbanut and his relationship with Rav Herzog and Heichal Shlomo. Remember, the Brisker Rav said it's usher, it's forbidden to step foot into Heichal Shlomo. The B'nai Brak people would never step foot. Rav El Yashiv was in Heichal Shlomo. That's where. So I give credit to the grandson who wrote a book, a biography, a couple of volumes, and he doesn't cover this up. Also, the book Hashakdan, another book, doesn't cover it up. So I guess we'd be grateful for these small things. Now, you might say, well, how can you cover it up? I mean, it's not ancient history. It's not. Believe me, you can cover it up. I wrote a blog post about how someone one of Gurel's sons, Rabbi Gurel's sons, actually wrote that his father never taught Gemara at YU. He only was there to teach Mussar and things like that. And it's like, we still have plenty of people alive who can testify that indeed he did teach Gemara. You know, maybe in 100 years you'll cover, you'll find something in the archives of YU and that shows him teaching Gemara, and they could say it's a test. You know, maybe it was created by someone to test your faith. That do you believe it? But we still have plenty of people who can testify to Rav Gurelitz having taught Gemara. But so I'm thankful that they haven't covered that up. Rav Avadi Yosef was on this Beis Din. Now Rav Avadi Yosef. We know him as probably the greatest authority in the last 50 years. I'm not, when I say that, I mean Ashkenazim, Sephardim. I don't buy into this whole thing. And I can quote you something later from Rabbi Shapiro. There is no such thing as Ashkenazi Sephardic halakha. When there's a dispute between the Ramah and the Shulchan Aruch, okay, we have a tradition, Ashkenazi, we follow the Ramah. But this idea that some people have that a Pesach Rav Avadi Yosef is for the Sephardim and a Pesach Rav Moshe is for the Ashkenazim, like we're two separate peoples, this is an unbelievable distortion of halachic Judaism. Rav Avadi Yosef is the Rav for all of Kol Yisrael. And a posek for everyone. So he's on this Beis Din. We've had classes on him, many classes, so I don't need to go any more into him. The third person is the most interesting. Let me show you who this is. We will have classes on him, hopefully, maybe after Shimon Shkup, because He is from the center of religious Zionism. Mir Kazarov student of Rav Kook and Rav Charlap, later Rosh Yeshiva Mir Kazarov, involved with religious Zionism, Rav Shaul Yisraeli, great posek. He wrote, by the way, the first real halachic discussions dealing with army halacha, things like that. So, the unbelievable figure, and what makes the story so interesting is that he is one of the opponents of Rav Gorin. You might think that this is religious Zionists backing Rav Gorin versus the Haredi, but it's not true. Rav Shaul Yisraeli was one of the biggest opponents of Rav Gorin on this whole matter. So those are the three Dayanim, Rav Elyashiv, Rav Vadya, and Rav Shaul Yisraeli. I remember it says he died in Sivan, June, 17th of June, 1995. I remember the day he died because I was in Israel. That 1995. Now it's coming back to me. I remember why exactly I was there. I was on a bus, and you probably remember. I don't know. I haven't been on a bus in Israel in a long time. I stopped during the Intifada, and I now Baruch Hashem. Usually, when I'm there, I'm going academic places, so my university, gives me money to pay for these cabs if I need it. But I remember when you'd be on it, you'd have at the top of the hour, Chadashot, and the no I don't know if they still do this on the bus announcements. People can tell me if they do, but the news comes on, and it might even be Motzei Shabbos. I can't remember, but it was in the evening. I heard it that Rav Shaul Yisraeli had passed away, and this girl, young woman with the long skirt, you could tell from the Merkaz world, you could tell what world they're from, because the Haredi world don't have skirts down to the ground. That's usur for them, if you can believe it. It's in the Haredi world, it's usur to have skirts down all the way. You have to have the skirts stop at the knee. She starts crying on the bus, which I thought was interesting. I had been together with Rav Shaul Yisraeli because I always had a thing for Merkaz, and I went there more than once on Shabbos. And on Friday night, they have gatherings there. And Rav Shaul Yisraeli he was one of the two Rosh Yeshiva. So in 1970, January, the Beis Din HaGadol affirms that they're Mamzerim. So that's sort of the end of the line. That's the Supreme Court. You can't go any further than that, under normal circumstances. So enter Rav Gorin. And this is going to be part of the problem also. We believe usually you have to follow a certain form you are in. There's a format, I should say, and you can't go around it. There are norms in courts, in rabbinic courts as well. On the other hand, we're going to see what Rav Nissim says in a little bit when dealing with a case of dine nefashos, that is life and death, because that's what this is. We shouldn't get so hung up on norms, and then there's options for going outside the norms. But Rav Gorin, Rav Shlomo Gorin, he actually began his involvement with this case in 1968. Both of the Langer kids were in the IDF, and they turned to Rav Gorin for help. Remember, this thing has been going on since 1966, when they found out that they weren't going to be allowed to marry. So they turned to Rav Gorin. Everyone in the army knew who Rav Gorin was. He traveled to different all the different army bases. He was a real personality. Rav Gorin, in turn, reaches out to different Dayanim, asking them if anything could be done to remove the taint of Mamzerus. But the Dayanim that he reached out to couldn't help him, the ones he reached out to. Rav Gorin, however, investigated the matter. Not that he had any authority. He's chief rabbi of the IDF. His role is only halacha in the IDF. He's not a rav ezrachi, I think is the term they use. He's not a communal rav. He's not a civilian rav. He was only involved in the IDF. And yet he believes, after investigating it, that he has a way to free the Mamzerim. Problem is, he doesn't have any authority to do it. And even if he was not in the IDF, even if he was a rav of a Tel Aviv, let's say, which he becomes shortly after this, he could not rule against the Beis Din HaGadol. The Beis Din HaGadol, that's why they call it the Beis Din HaGadol. That's the Supreme Court. That's it's like in America, you know, we have a Supreme Court. You think that your local New York court then could overrule the Supreme Court? Of course not. The only ones who could overrule the Beis HaGadol were the chief rabbis. It's in the law, I guess, of the organizational bylaws, however you want to call it, of the court system that the chief rabbis could do this. And I believe you need both of them on board to do it, both of them. Rav Nissim, one of the chief rabbis was Rav Yitzhak Nissim. Let me show you a picture here of, I think I have it. If not, I'll find it, of Rav Yitzhak Nissim. We have classes on Rav Nissim as well. Here is Rav Nissim. He was chief rabbi for a number of years. For a while, he was the only chief rabbi in the after Rav Uziel died in the early 50s. And so he's chief rabbi about 20 years. You can go back to our classes on him. I think a lot of people admired Rav Nissim because when the Pope came to Israel, Rav Nissim refused to go visit meet him. Pope Paul, this was, and he came to see some Christian sites, and he said, "Why should I?" And a whole Israeli delegation, Golda Meir and the foreign minister, I think was she foreign minister then, prime minister, they went to the Pope to meet the Pope, and they asked for Rav Nissim as the only chief rabbi to come along, and he says, "I'm not going." He says, "I'm happy to meet the Pope, but he's coming into the sovereign state of Israel as a foreign leader. He has to come visit us, and he should come visit the president, and he should come visit the prime minister, and come visit me as the chief rabbi. And just because the prime minister and the president are showing little Jewish pride by going out and meeting the Pope, that doesn't mean that I represent the Torah. If the Pope wants, he has to come here." And by the way, Rav Nissim did this a second time. Well, maybe more problematic. He comes to New York. He comes to Yeshiva University, by the way, and the Rav gives a talk, which, as far as I know, only sections of it have been published. But the Rav speaks about the Rambam, and he says, "When I think of the Rambam, I think of Rav Nissim, you know, because the way the Rambam looked, and he imagines the Rambam with the garb, and he thinks of Rav Nissim." But he's in New York, and he doesn't go visit the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And we're going to see Rav Gorin did go. The relationship between Rav Gorin and the Lubavitcher Rebbe is very complicated and interesting. We'll get to that hopefully today. So they asked Rav Nissim, "Why don't you want to go visit the Lubavitcher Rebbe? Everyone goes visit the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Zalman Shazar would come. He'd go. Everyone goes." And Rav Nissim said, "If the Lubavitcher Rebbe commits to move to go to visit Eretz Yisrael, then I'll go visit the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Because otherwise, what do I need to visit the Lubavitcher Rebbe for?" He's a Chutz La'aretz rabbi, it's not, you know, the Rav Nissim as a Sephardic rabbi didn't appreciate, I think, who the Lubavitcher Rebbe was. So Rav Nissim speaks to Rav Gorin, and this is becoming a big controversy because Moshe Dayan, one of the Gerlanger, she worked in Moshe Dayan's, I don't want to say his office, but there was some connection to his office. And he learned of this case, and he began talking to everyone. And I forget now her name; it escapes me. But someone will write it in. And the newspaper started covering it, so it becomes a big koseleb. And Rav Nissim asks Rav Gorin, since Rav Gorin had explained to him, he thinks that there's a way to free them, that Rav Gorin should write up his halachic opinion on the matter. And Rav Gorin also says. He himself says that he was asked to do so by senior people in the state, namely politicians. So already we see there's a problem here, because this is going to be a big criticism that did politics influence Rav Gorin. But in any event, let's leave this aside for now. We'll come back to it. Rav Nissim asked Rav Gorin to write up his halachic opinion, which will then be shared by various dayanim. Because if Rav Gorin has uncovered new information or a new approach, then the Dayanim will be able to revisit the matter. That's what the courts do. While doing so, Rav Gorin comes up with new evidence that leads him to conclude that the children were not mamzerim for the simple reason that there's no evidence that Borukhovsky, the first husband, the Polish non-Jew, had ever converted. No evidence. And we have to understand how halacha works. Is it possible that Borukhovsky converted? Yes, it's possible, but there's no evidence of it. We just have, and we're going to go through in detail later when I go through with you Rav Gorin Sefer. I'll read you the evidence, And mamzerim are freed all the time, and agunos are freed all because of the fact that there's no evidence. We don't say maybe he was converted. The question is there any evidence that it happened, especially when people's lives are like are on the line like this? So we'll get back to his halachic argumentation later because he publishes an entire book. But for now, that's all we need to know. Rav Nissim says, after receiving Rav Gorin's opinion, that he's going to form a special Beis Din, which would examine the issue, taking into account the new information of Rav Gorin and the arguments, and they'll come to a ruling. And this is all taking place, as I said, at the same time that, in fact, as I recall, both Langers were in Moshe Dayan's larger defense, oh, I think it was defense ministry, yeah, defense ministry. And so Moshe Dayan is pressuring members of the rabbinate. By the way, Golda Meir, prime minister, also gets involved, and she starts pressuring the chief rabbinate to come up with a heter. The chief rabbis are Rav Nissim, who's inclined to a heter, and Rav Unterman, the Yisrael Unterman Ashkenazi, who's not inclined. There is movement, and this is also an important part of the story, in the Knesset to institute civil marriage. The argument is made that halachic marriage is fine as long as people can all get married. But now that we have a case, and this became such a famous case where we see that some people can't be married by the rabbinate, and this is a modern state in 1970, 71, and 72, we can't have a situation where citizens of the state of Israel are not allowed to marry in their own state. And then we're going to send them to Cyprus and things like that. So there's movement, strong movement, that if you cannot solve this question, this problem, rabbis, that we will institute civil marriage, and therefore those who want halachic marriage can have halachic marriage, and everyone else will have civil marriage. And Rav Gorin thought that this was a very important consideration, one that should be involved in halachic give and take. Now, this is not something from left field. This is not something out of the halachic system. Every posek considers all these sorts of matters. And if halachic marriage is important, and for Rav Gorin, halachic marriage in the state of Israel was vital. He believed in the state, the Jewish state. And for it to be a Jewish state, you need to have halachic marriage. If you're a posek, let's say in Bnei Brak, who doesn't really, is not interested in that, Rav Shach, for instance, who said we should have civil marriage, it didn't concern him. He's not tied into the state of Israel as important part of his vision. He doesn't care about that. So for him, and why would he believe in civil marriage? Because then there's no mamzerus issues. Only religious Jews get married halachically. If you're not religious, we're going to force a kibbutznik who's a complete secularist to halachic marriage. And then when he's done, he's not going to get a halachic divorce or mamzerim. Or maybe they sleep around. Who knows? In other words, Rav Shach's point is that we don't care about that. It's not, we don't force people to get married halachically if they don't want to. But for Rav Gorin, who had a Mamlachti understanding, a religious Zionist understanding, the whole idea of a Jewish state has to have halacha in its system. Okay. In 1971, Rav Gorin publishes a booklet, privately publishes a booklet, making his case, and sends it to lots of rabbis for asking for their comments. Now, hold on a second. I have never seen that booklet. If anyone has it, PDF, please send it to me. I mean, I'm not in Israel now. If I was in Israel, I'm sure I can get it at the National Library. Maybe I will be in Israel soon. But I don't need to see the book before I'm doing now, because I'll show you why. Later, Rav Gorin would publish this, a whole volume, thick volume, which has his halachic argument, and we're going to go through this book. This is a very, very rare book. I don't even remember where I got it. It was never reprinted. As far as I know, there's no PDF. Someone should make a PDF. I haven't made a PDF because I don't want to break the binding of it. It's not an Otzer HaChachma. Otzer HaChachma is such an interesting phenomenon. You can chart developments, I guess, by what books. They have like a rabbinic, at least one rabbi, I'm told, instructing them or giving them permission which books to put on. So, for instance, years ago, Otzer HaChachma, the commentary of Rabbi Yehuda Chassid on Torah, was the censored version, not the version that, you know, Rav Moshe Feinstein said it's usher, although he said it's usher to read the entire Yehuda Chassid. when he came out against the parish of Yehuda Chassid, Rav Moshe didn't like any of it. But in the end, they only took out the what we would call the biblical criticism. So for years on Otzer Chachma, it was the censored version of the Rav Yehuda Chassid's commentary on the Torah. Now, if you go on there, it's the complete commentary. It has everything. And I think that's because more has come out, more has been published. So we see that Rav Yehuda Chassid's view about post-Mosaic verses is found in other places, among other Rishonim. It's not a unique, crazy thing. In the early years, none of Rav Gorin's books were on Otzer Chachma, because Rav Gorin is persona non grata in the Haredi world, and probably most users of the Otzer Chachma are the Haredi world. It's certainly published by people in that world. Now, if you look on Otzer Chachma, you have all of his Sfarim. The only Sefer you don't have is the one I just showed you. And I have it on good authority that it's still too hot to handle. And they're afraid if they put that on, then there'll be such an outcry, they'll be forced to take off all the books of Rav Gorin. And but then they want to have the books of Rav Gorin because they're important works. Although I haven't seen the booklet, what I have seen are quotations from it and other writers. So I can tell you that at the beginning of the booklet, Rav Gorin states that I am not ruling against the Beis Din HaGadol here. I am just sending out my ideas, and I haven't found a heter. I haven't found a permission. I rather am pointing out to the Dayanim these sources and this new evidence. The big thing for Rav Gorin is the evidence he uncovered, which was not known by the Dayanim on the Beis Din HaGadol, and therefore I want you to look at this to see if we can come to a new ruling. Now, in the end, Rav Nissim does not establish his own Beis Din. That was the plan originally. Rav Nissim was going to establish his own Beis Din with this information, find some other Dayanim, maybe the Dayanim from the Beis Din HaGadol, maybe others, and then they could rule that the kids are not Amzerim. In the end, Rav Nissim seems to chicken out, and he does not establish this Beis Din. But he believed, and this was the general assumption, that when Rav Gorin becomes chief rabbi, he would do this. He'd be able to do this. Now, while all this is going on, Rav Gorin is running for the he's chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. Let me just get the, hold on a second. So I give you the exact year. I want to say what year in 68, he becomes chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. I just checked it. And within 2 years, there's talk now about a new election. And Rav Gorin wants to be chief rabbi. And that's why that little booklet came out against him. Moshe Dayan, as I said, was making, had taken the family under the wing, his wing, and was making all sorts of noise in the press. I want to read you something here. Rav Nissim, they recently published his responsa. He published two volumes of responsa called Yain HaTov, Yud Yud Nun HaTov. It's a pasuk, I think it's in Shir HaShirim. I just mention it because many people, when they transliterate, they say Yain HaTov. It's not Yain HaTov. It's in the construct. It's Yain HaTov. I guess we'd write it Y-E-I-N. Some people write it Y-E-N, but I think you have to put the I in there. So there's two volumes of responsa. But then he has other responsa that are being published now. They have an institute called Yad HaRav Nissim. How is there such an institute? Where they got all this government money? That's because Rav Nissim had two sons. One of his sons was the great scholar Meir Benayahu. And the other son, his name was Moshe Nissim. Now, Moshe Nissim was a justice minister. He had all sorts of roles in the government. And apparently, the story is that he funneled lots of money to create this institute in memory of his father. It's right near, I think it's in Jerusalem. I forget what street it's on, but you pass it all the time. They've also published letters of Rav Nissim, very interesting letters. They're called Lador Ulidorot, Yahadut Halacha V'Chevra. So if you look in volume 3, number 40, you have a short letter to Moshe Dayan from Rav Nissim. And he says to him that, the matter of the Langer case that we spoke about, you see, Moshe Dayan is really involved with this. He says, I'm focused on it. And he says, after we spoke, I learned through the tikkim, that is the files. And he says, a few days ago, we had a meeting with me and the Sar HaMishpatim, the Justice Minister, the Sar HaDatot, the Religious Affairs Minister, that was Zorach Varhafteg, the Yoetz Mishpati, LeMemshala, I don't know how, why you translate that into English, what the term they use is, and also the Rav the advisor to the government, I don't know, the Attorney General, whatever, I don't know in Israel what they call it, they don't call it Attorney General, but, and also the Rav Rashi of Tzahal, the chief rabbi of the armed forces. Now, this is in 1971. He still was serving as chief rabbi, even though he's the chief rabbi at Tel Aviv as well. And he says, my wish is that the matter will come to its conclusion. Yavo al pitro no. So you see Rav Nissim behind the scenes is working this. And then you have another letter from the summer of 1931, a very long letter to Moshe Dayan. He says that you should know that I've started to work on this matter. Seriously, that means with Rav Gorin to do something. He says, I spoke to Rav Karelitz, the Av Beis Din of Tel Aviv. He says, we've given the matter. We want to give the matter, he says, to Rav Avram Shapiro. This is going to be a name that's also going to be important in this story. Rav Avraham Shapiro. Where is Rav Avraham Shapiro? I have to pick. There he is. Avraham Elkanah Shapiro. Rosh Hashiva America Zarav becomes chief rabbi of the state of Israel. A real goon in learning from Chevron Yeshiva. He was asked to become Rosh Hashiva Ponevej by Rav Kahneman. But he was familiar. He was related to the Rav Cook's family. So he became the Rosh Hashiva of Merkaz. And I think, had he gone to Ponevez, he might have just adopted the Haredi perspective. But he adopted more a Chardal perspective. And in many ways, Chardal is more close-minded. But in other ways, it's much more open-minded. But he comes out of that world. He was the Kohen in the Briskerov's minion. We did classes on him as well. Now, Rav Nissim describes, however, that Rav Avram Shapiro, who's an Av Beis Din in Jerusalem, he refuses to take the case, even though Rav Nissim wants him to, because he says that the Beis Din in Petach Tikva hasn't given permission, and they're the last ones to really examine the case. Now, this is the Beis Din HaGadol is actually, hold on, let me get the dates here. No, this is the summer of 71. And, no, this is a Beis. Apparently, what happened was the Beis Din HaGadol asked, if I'm not mistaken, they asked the Petach Tikva again to look at it, and Petach Tikva refused to look at it. So you have the ruling of Petach Tikva and the ruling of Beis Din HaGadol. And Rav Avraham Shapiro says he has no authority to, look at it. The other Batei Din have not, recuse themselves, and Rav Nissim says he wants to create a Beis Din with Rav Shapiro, Avraham Shapiro, and also Rav Ehrenberg. He was an Av Beis Din in Tel Aviv. And he would also be in it, I guess, Rav Nissim, but Rav Shapiro refused to be a part of of such a Beis Din. The only thing he would do would be look at the matter, but he's not going to be part of any other Beis Din. And whatever, he goes on complaining about Rav Avraham Shapiro, and this is what and Rav Avraham Shapiro is raising all sorts of matters of formality. That how can I take this? How can I be part of this when the other Batei Din has not removed himself from it? And what does Rav Nissim say? That these arguments that Rav Avraham Shapiro is, he says, I'm annoyed with Rav Avraham Shapiro. These arguments of Rav Avraham Shapiro, when you place them opposite the Ach and the Achot, he says, this is like I in the Ephes. Kol inyan the procedura, the whole procedure thing of returning the tik, the file to this Beis Din and that Beis Din is not halacha. He says it's not any safer. He says this is just the way we establish they established that the Beis Din should work. So yes, that one Beis Din can't take it if another Beis Din has it in its authority, unless the other Beis Din, let's say, gives approval that now you can do it, because although we've ruled on it, now we give you permission to. We can understand why you have to do that. That otherwise, any Beis Din can come and counter another Beis Din, and you'd have no closure. But Rav Nissim says, in a case like this, where it deals with, he says, in a Sheila Kochashuva, in such an important case, where it deals with Dinei Nefashot, where people's lives are at stake here, he says, are we going to allow formalities to determine this, which have no Yesod and Halacha? They're just, he says, in a case like this, Kochamorsha, Dinei Nefashot Tuyot Bo, he says, in a case like that, we have to forget about the formality. That he says there's no such thing as following formality and rules when faced like a case like this. And therefore, if any Beis Din can do it, it doesn't matter what the other Beis Din were going to do it. And then at the end, he says, it's terrible that all the publicity this case has been given, he says, that's what's causing all the problems and false information. And this really, in the end, is going to be the unfortunate thing. Because it became such a popular case in the media, and it became an example of the irreligious attacking Halacha and attacking Daranim, that the Orthodox, especially the Haredim, had to then respond to it and affirm Halacha. Had the case never been a public matter? Had it been done under the table quietly, like so many other cases do? Does anyone ever know the names of Mamzerim? No, these are all handled quietly. It never would have been an issue. I'm convinced of that. And just so you don't get a wrong impression of Rav Avram Shapiro, I want to read you from the Sefer, page 340, where Rav Avram Shapiro, and he was perfectly willing to allow another Beis Din or another Dayan to overrule him. But to take the case from another court and just say, well, you ruled one way, well, we're going to rule differently, that's not how the court systems work. There has to be some sort of order. You can't just have any court establish itself and contradict another court. By the way, I mentioned this is a good story, so I'll say it. I know you like Maaseo stories, so in the book it tells this story. So Rav Avram Shapiro was the Kohen, the Brisker of Zalevi, and they had a small minion. So there's this rabbi in Bnei Brak, his name is Yosef Lieberman. So he published a book, and he made the argument that a Levi, who's a big Talmud Chacham, doesn't have to get up and go out and wash the hands of the Kohanim. You know, it's beneath his honor. Let the other Levim do it. And he says that the Brisker Rav never washed any, who's the God of Adar, he says, never washed any Kohen's hand, because he's greater than all the Levim. He's greater than all the Kohanim. So he's butter from washing it. So Ravram Shapiro says, what nonsense. He says, I was the Kohen. And the Brisker Rav would get up and go to the sink and wash my hands every day, you know, because they do it. But then Rav Shapiro tells an interesting story. He says, once when he's washing my hands, this little kid comes over. He says a kid. I don't know if it's over bar mitzvah, under bar mitzvah. Imagine probably a 13-year-old or something. And this kid says to the Brisker Rav, now wash my hands. And the Brisker Rav says to him, go back to your mother. So I guess he's under bar mitzvah. And he goes, I'm not washing your hands. Go back to your mother. But on page 340, and we'll end with this, he has a case here from a rabbi, Shimon Biton. He's the rabbi of Beit Shemesh. I don't know if he's still alive now. He was a dayan in Marrakesh, in Morocco, before he went on Aliyah, at the end of Jewish life in Marrakesh, when there still was a base in, there still is Jewish life. God willing, we will return to Morocco. We wanted to go this year, but we didn't have enough people sign up. I get it, with the war and all that, but Morocco is very safe. You got to worry about the streets of Manhattan and Toronto and Montreal and Los Angeles these days more than you have to worry about Morocco. But so he had a case, which it was a problem with yichus of the lineage of two daughters, and Rav Avram Shapiro was a dayan, and after investigating, he couldn't come up with a heter. So Biton, he found room, perhaps that you could find a heter. So he went to Rav Avram Shapiro, and Rav Avram Shapiro said, you know, I can't find a heter. I don't agree. But go to Rav Mordechai Yahu and see what he thinks. And Rav Mordechai Yahu established another Beis Din, in which this, I guess, Rav Bitton was on it, and Rav Mordechai Yahu, and Rav Masas, the chief rabbi of Jerusalem, and they martyred the girls. And he ends by saying that Rav Avram Shapiro Maran, he wasn't worried about his kavod. The most important thing is that something be done. If you can find a heter for these poor girls, you find a heter. If he couldn't find the heter, he has to be honest, he can't find the heter. So if another dayan can, he can. And that's what's going to make the case of Rav Gorin such a strange case, because it's not just Rav Gorin, it's nine other dayanim. If the Beis Din HaGadol couldn't find a heter, you're worrying about formalities. These people's lives are at stake. Why is it so problematic? However, I'll just add one more point that Rav Avadya Yosef is famous to always being able to find a heter. I mean, well, he was always able to find something. He could not find a heter in this case. So it shows you it's not a simple matter. It's a complicated issue, and we will definitely get into the meat of it next class, because let me just look ahead in my notes here. Even before we get into the actual heter itself, we have to get into the fact that this whole thing is tied in with Rav Gorin running for the chief rabbinate. Since when can you unseat a sitting Rav? Rav Gorin is running for the chief rabbinate, which means he's going to unseat Rav Unterman. And he has the backing of the labor government and Knesset members. That's going to become a huge controversy as well. For some reason, Rav Avadya Yosef unseating Rav Nissim doesn't become a controversy, and we'll learn together. Well, I'll read to you. I'll summarize it. Rav Avadya Yosef's justification for why he could run against Rav Nissim. All the people, the Lubavitcher Rebbe or Moshe Feinstein, who are against Rav Gorin for unseating Rav Unterman, the same thing applies should apply to Rav Avadya Yosef. And if Rav Avadya Yosef's reasons why he's allowed to unseat rabbis apply, then it should apply to Rav Gorin. By the way, so we'll look at the tshuva. Anyone is interested in the situation of not hiring, rehiring your rabbi after he served, let's say, for a few years, and you want a new rabbi? That's what Rav Avadya is going to deal with, and the Chazon and the Chasam Sofer, etc. So, and we'll do the Lubavitcher Rebbe next class also. But so let's pick up. Let me get to the questions here, comments. Charlie says you spent the Shabbos in Anchorage at the Chabad there, and they only did Shabbat on Friday and Saturday. Nothing about Torah on another day. No one even asked about the issue. Well, first of all, Alaska is not a problem. Alaska is not an issue. There's no one has the there's no issue about Alaska. Although Rav Molliver actually thought there should be a problem with Alaska, but not Rav Tukachinsky, not the Chazon Ish, nothing. But I can tell you, Charlie, that in Japan, the Chabad also only does Shabbos, Saturday. There's no other issue. That's the Chabad approach, and that was the approach in Japan from the people who were in Japan. You have Chabadniks in Japan also, because before they went to Shanghai, they went to Japan.
About
It's only in
Hawaii
recent
also.
years.
About in
But,
Hawaii also. Hawaii is an issue, and they also only hold it on Shabbos.
well, Hawaii is an issue according to Rav Tukachinsky.
Right.
That's right. So Rav Tukachinsky, but maybe Rav Tukachinsky, you say, is not at the same level as the Chazon Ish. Yes, Hawaii is not. Rabbi Kelman, you said your son-in-law was recently in Japan and was told to observe Shabbos on Saturday, but observed Torah law on Sunday. So you have to ask him why he observed that. He obviously asked a
I
shayla, and he
think
was told that. I'm telling you,
I'll
that's
speak to him
become the
again.
new view.
Correct. But he's like a YU, like, you know, middle of the road, not, that's what I'm saying. And, you know, that's what he was taught, you were saying, to change him suck. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's becoming now. But again, I still think that's only for visitors. I don't think, I find it hard to believe they would say otherwise. Charlie says the international dateline moved in October 1867 from the eastern boundary of Alaska to the Bering Strait. If you hold the international, it was hold my sukkah, which brings us other issues. Okay, listen. According to those who hold that the dateline is wherever we establish it, like Ritzi Pesach Frank or of Kosher, it's not an issue because wherever it's established. The other poskim, they don't care what the secular world thinks. They hold by Torah, a Torah dateline. And Chaim said Chabad actually had skin in the game in Japan. As Tomchei Tamimim there was there with everyone else, they need an answer. Rebbe Reatz told them Shabbos, not Sunday. Yes. And this goes back to the Psak of Rav Kislev, who was the Rav in Harbin. And he's the Rav of the Far East. He gave the Psak there. And in Shanghai, the Hasidim who were there and, many of the yeshiva students, they all followed Saturday. The ones who followed the Chazon Ish, they followed Sunday. Chaim says, Rabbi Taplin, whose sefer you mentioned, was on Halacha Edlines podcast some years ago and responded when asked for a practical directive, something along the lines of, Yirei Shamayim should not go to Hawaii or Alaska. I think Alaska, because maybe it gets, not because of the dateline, but because the Zman and Shabbos in the summer, when does it end? When does it start? And Rav Sternbach says this about Finland. Don't go, you shouldn't go to Finland because we don't exactly know when Shabbos begins and ends. I have to say, though, and I did see, looking at Rabbi Taplin Sefer, he quotes someone who says you shouldn't go on Shabbos to a place like Japan. I have to say that to me, I don't accept that. First of all, in Finland, you always had communities there. Rav Yitzchak Blazer was the Rav there, but the Torah has answers for everything. And the idea that we're going to say that parts of the world are off limits because there's a machlokes, there's always been machlokes. So there was machlokes in medieval times. Rosh Hashanah, is it one day or 2 days? Do you know that there were people in Eretz Yisrael, they did 1 day. The Baal Amor talks about why they changed it from 1 day to 2 days. It's from these pesky people that come from Provence. We'll talk about it this summer, but I mean, I just can't, my mind can't wrap myself around this to say that there's places on this world that Jews should not go. Maybe, I mean, obviously, Kavah Homer, they'll say, then you can't go to the moon, but on this earth where God wants us to dwell, we're supposed to be able to dwell everywhere on earth. At least that's what I think. Oh, I didn't know Rabbi Taplin has a website. I don't even know if you can type it in, Chaim, what Rabbi Taplin's own shita is, if he has a shita, or does he just summarize the different views? Nissen says, do you mean a freed shifcha marrying a mamzer? Hold on. I'll read you what the Rambam says here. Hold on a second. The actual language. Hold on. No, by the way, it's not freed. It's you marry the Shifcha Kananis, and then the children can be freed. The husband, the man who's the mamzer has a child with the Shifcha, and then the children who are born as avadim, they're not mamzerim. Then he frees them. That's what you do. And by the way, in this case, the children don't have the taint of mamzerus. That's unlike if a mamzer marries a convert, then the children still are mamzerim. So
why is the mamzer mutter in a shivcha if he's every Yisrael is also in a shivcha unless he's an Eved Ivri?
No, that's the lacha. I'll read you the Rambam. That's the explicit. Explicit halacha. That is it. Let's see. I think it's Isuri Bia. Yudalit, I think. Is it Yudalit? Hold on. I'll read it to you. Let me find the exact place for you. The Gemara speaks about this. It's 50. Yeah. Here. This. Let me read it to you. It's in chapter 15. It says, "Kitiru amamzer lisos shifcha kedei lahateres banav sharehu meshachar osam benim so bnei chori the lo gazra lo shifcha amamzer mipnei tekalas banim." So you can look in the Hilchos Shirabia Perikas Vav Halacha Dalid, and you can see it's in the Gemara. I believe it's in Sanhedrin where they discuss all this. By the way, the Rabbi Breish, the Chalkas Yaakov, he talks about this as a and the Minchas Yitzchak as a practical way of dealing with mamzerus, but they have a problem because they say that slavery is illegal. and it goes against Dina Malchus Adina, so he can't do it. But Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg is quoted as doing it halacha l'maisa. He thought this is a very nice solution. So the woman has to agree to be a shifcha. I don't know what that means in contemporary times. Rabbi Frankel, I mean, sorry, MJ Frankel, I spent a year of Gerel Kshir, and of course it was straight Gemara. Leavened by his occasional outbursts about his dissatisfaction with things in the school, or with Dr. Belkin or some such. And Rabbi Rakefet also wrote about some of his, Rav Gorelick was a real a character, and I mean, he's famous for that. Mel says, Haredi skirts do not stop at the knee. They stop below the knee, yes, but right below the knee, but they won't go below that, the ankle. Even though the Mishnah Brura says that that's what it should happen. And it's not that they don't have to. Actually, they say you can't have the skirt down all the way because that's like the religious Zionists. So the skirt has to go right below the knee. Cannot go, the calf. Is that what you call that thing? I mean, it sounds strange. I mean, I have a sefer where he polemicized against the Haredim. You're saying because you don't like the religious Zionists, you're going to say that you shouldn't do this when the Mishnah Berurah holds it's a better form of tznius. But that's the reality. Gershon says he used to attend Rosh Yisrael's weekly shiurim when he was at Karen B'Av. Rosh Yisrael was also the Rav of, as I recall, of Kfar Haroa for a time. No, sorry, Rav Neria was the Rav. No, Yisraeli was the Rav also. He also wrote, he edited a book on Jewish thought, on like just selections of thinkers. But he's a posek, a great posek. He wrote Chuvos, Amud Hayamini, well, that's his halacha sefer. And he also was the halacha authority of Eretz Chemda, the religious Zionist Kolel, and he wrote two volumes of Chuvos, which names escaped me. If you look in Brody's new book on Jewish law and war, he quotes Rosh Yisraeli a lot. Rosh Yisraeli was the first one to deal with army halacha in the state of Israel. Ah, yes, thank you, David. Miriam Winger. The title of the booklet, for one who asked me, is Hamaracha al Hatzalat HaRabanut. The grouping or whatever, how you translate the maracha, the word escapes me now, but the taking the stand to save the Rabbanut from Rav Goren's approach, basically. And Rabbi Yellen says, in the story of the Get of Cleves, one court overruled a court of a different jurisdiction a number of times. But the thing is, in Cleves, all you have are different cities with different Bate Din. In the state of Israel, you have a system of courts. And you, Rabbi Yellen, you're a lawyer. You know a lot better than me. But when you have a whole system of courts, that's different. Because you can't have a court, let's say, if the Supreme Rabbinic Court rules one way, you can't have that a private court in Jerusalem when it's part of the rabbinic system. Or, you know, you can't have the Tel Aviv Rabbinic Court and overruling the Supreme Court if they're part of the same thing. But before we had the State of Israel with an official rabbinic court, all you had was a lot of courts. Every city has its own court. And by the way, in the story of Cleves, wasn't it all the different courts against Frankfurt, and Frankfurt held its own. Frankfurt's not going to back down because of anyone. Now, Jack says, didn't Rav Nissen promise Rav Goren that he would set up a base in to consider the new facts? Yes, well, that's okay. That you asked that before I got to it. Can I clarify what I mean by Rav Goren was unseating Rav Unterman? Doesn't the chief rabbi sit for a 5-year term? Are you saying Rav Goren was lobbying to have Rav Unterman removed early? No. First of all, originally there was no terms. Then they put these things in. The question is, who says you can remove a rabbi? The Chasam Sofer claims that the reason for terms, because even in the Chasam Sofer state, you gave a rabbi a contract, let's say 5 years or 3 years. The reason for this, the Chasam Sofer says, so that the rabbi, after the end of his term, he can take another position. It's not for the Kehillah. If I'm the Rav, let's say, in Pressburg, and my 5-year term finishes, I now have finished my obligations to the community, I can go to Frankfurt or take a bigger rabbonus. However, if I want to stay in Pressburg, the community cannot get rid of me. That's what the Chasam Sofer says. A Rav has lifetime tenure. Rav Moshe is going to deal with this. He's going to say today he doesn't, because when you hired, we don't have that assumption. But that's so the idea, which we'll see the Lubavitcher Rebbe very sharply. Well, the Lubavitcher Rebbe was very friendly with Rav Goren, and he felt he had to come out against some of the others, is that Rav Unterman, just because the secular state of Israel decides they're going to make a 5-year term, doesn't mean that we can kick a rabbi out. No, the Chasam Sofer says that as long as the rabbi can do the job, he remains as rabbi. So that's what I'm referring to. So, and it was understood by everyone as kicking Rav Unterman out, and because Rav Goren didn't need to run for election. So I'll tell you the whole story next class.
Henry VIII should have known the psak about Cleves because he divorced Anne of Cleves.
Yeah, but it was, as I recall, it was the Frankfurt-based din that was the big one, and the other batei din were against it. So here, thank you, Chaim. Rabbi Taplin's conclusion, he's following the rulings of, sorry, Rabbi Chaim of Yisrael Taplin, and he says, he goes like Rav Tukhachinsky. So all points west of, so according to this, most of, I'm wrong what I said then. According to this, he's saying that most of the larger cities in Alaska would supposed to be Shabbos on a different day, on Friday. Am I getting this right, Chaim? I thought that Rav Tukhachinsky is only Hawaii, and that we don't distinguish Alaska because Alaska is it's land where people are living. Okay, but he's saying here that that according to this Rav Tukhachinsky, even some areas of Alaska. Okay, that's news to me. And Elana says that we were taught no ankle-length skirts because of it being the fashion. Yes, it's fashion. But I think in Israel, it's fashion, not fashion like the irreligious. The irreligious don't wear it. It's fashion. Who's the fashion? The fashion are the Gush Emunim, the Merkaz types. They're the ones wearing it. And Rav Goren's name, okay, I already repeated it. Yes, and Joel, we'll end with this. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik claimed in the 70s he could not be fired as Rosh Yeshiva in Chicago. The problem for Rav Aaron was that the board did not share that view, and they regarded him as someone who was hired by the board, and therefore he could be fired. And I have to say, in the name of correct history, that it wasn't just the board. It was the other Torah teachers at the the yeshiva, in Skokie Yeshiva. They thought that Rav Aaron was their equal and that they were all. Rav Aaron thought he was the Rosh Yeshiva, but the others didn't think so. They thought he was just another Rebbe. And so Rav Aaron was sort of, he wasn't just at odds with the administration, he was at odds with the other Rebbeim in the yeshiva. I hate to say it, I actually have a document signed by the other teachers in the yeshiva siding with the administration in this matter. So, thank you, Chaim, though, for pointing it out. And I'm going to investigate Rav Tukhachinsky because I was sure, I didn't know that Alaska is also an issue. And so I take back what I said. Thank you all very much for coming out. We're starting to get exciting now. This is a fascinating issue. We have a huge crowd joined us tonight. I think at one point I saw 98 people on with us. So Baruch Hashem, that's nice. And 72, we're almost at 10 minutes to 10. So you stayed with us a long time. So thank you all very much. Rabbi Kelman.